Thank you. I'm also very excited that there's more of you now than there are of us. Thanks for sticking around. So I'm going to present a program that IPPF-WHR undertook in three countries in Latin America, in Peru, Bolivia, and Guatemala. And with a caveat that I came on board at IPPF at the time of dissemination of the results of the evaluation. So if you have very specific questions, I may have to get back to you. But what is IPPF? I don't know if everyone here knows. We are an organization, a global organization whose central office is in London, and in the Western Hemisphere region that has its office in New York. We were a network of 40 sexual and reproductive health organizations that provide everything from sexuality education to STI testing, pregnancy testing, contraceptive services, colposcopy. A lot of our member associations also provide general health care. So Latin America, in terms of the Millennium Development Goals and MDG-5, if you're familiar, has made the least progress. Adolescent fertility rates in Latin America and the Caribbean surpass the world average, and they're exceeded only by the African region. Social and economic inequality has grown in the last 15 years, and the fertility rate is increasing among the poorest adolescents in Latin America and the Caribbean. So young people are often the hardest hit by inequalities, by greater vulnerability, and they suffer from greater vulnerability to poor health outcomes. And that's really the motivation behind trying to reach out to young people. However, I think that there can be some resistance in our field to doing so. I've heard people in the field say that working with young people living on the street or working with the poorest of the poor is, you know, amounts to charity because you're not actually reaching young people who can then do systems change or things like that. So we differ, or we hope that we differ with this project by showing that there is a chance to do both and really to reach young people in a way that helps them improve their livelihood in addition to just meeting their day-to-day needs. You know, high exposure to the street can generate the risk of police brutality, drug trafficking, sex trafficking, sexual assault, gang involvement. There's a high number of unintended pregnancies and STIs among young people who are living on the street. There's little or no access to healthcare services. So you can imagine it may not be where these young people live, and there may also be stigma that would prevent them from going to the places where it is available, even if it's within a mile or two radius of where they are. So the program that I'm going to speak about was a three-year initiative funded by the European Commission from 2007 to 2009 in these three countries. And IPPF Western Hemisphere had done some work with vulnerable populations in the past, but I'd say more in a piecemeal way. And this was our first real effort to do it in a really organized fashion in three countries in a way that had involved research and evaluation so that we could try to show some of our impact. So in these three countries, we did tailor strategies to the local context and defined what our relevant subpopulations were going to be. And then we used cross-cutting strategies in the three countries that I'll talk about in a minute. But essentially, it's a peer-based approach, which includes harm reduction principles in order to make a positive impact both on the lives of the young people and their communities. To try to help empower youth living in vulnerable circumstances to be agents in their own lives. And a lot of other nice things, but that's not really saying anything. I mean, the important piece about this, I'm reading this and I'm like, you're not learning anything about this by me reading that. So it was a peer-based approach, and the most important piece of it was that we partnered with local organizations who were already providing some kind of service to young people living on the street. And what was mainly missing from their lives was the sexual and reproductive health services, and that's something that IPPF, you know, obviously specializes in, and our member associations in these three countries could provide. So that partnership was key. And also our experience with doing peer education so that we were able to train peer leaders from these communities, so either people who were still currently young people living on the streets or formerly living on the streets, so that they would be able to reach out to their peers. Okay, so the cross-cutting strategies across the three countries were that it was a rights-based service approach, that we provided the full range of primary health and SRH services, because especially in the case of this population, there's a lot of primary health needs in addition to the SRH needs. We also targeted the most at risk, which included adolescents, which included the very young adolescents, the 10 to 14, and focusing on behavior change by linking the clinical and the educational services. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. We also built a coherent service response through linking the SRH service delivery systems to other services through these partnerships that I'm talking about. So existing partnerships, existing organizations already working with vulnerable youth. And finally, we addressed provider needs for training and their core competencies, and also identifying the needs for self-care. We found, I'm going to talk about this in a minute too, but we found that providers who work with vulnerable youth or youth living on the street suffer from a lot of burnout, and that was a big need to address. Okay, so one of, I guess, our proudest result of this project was that we had a huge increase in services overall for young people in these, based on this project in these three countries. This is total services, so this is sexual and reproductive health and other services provided in the three countries over the 3 years of the project. So for the recipients of this project. And the total services were, over 200,000. So in general, for vulnerable youth, the utilization of services tends to be low, and the unmet need for all health services remains very high. And in this context, we're, excited that we reached over 165,000 young people, ages 10 to 24. And over time, there was a steep upward trend in the service uptake. There was no plateau, it just continued to increase, which shows the continued high demand and the unmet need for services for this population. Okay, and a key challenge of this program was reaching the younger adolescents, but we found that over 20% of the service users were between 10 and 14. And the vast majority, over 60%, were under 19, which is not the case, I would say, in our general service delivery in Latin America and the Caribbean. So this is the services. These are the services that were offered. There was consistency around the types and the proportion of services used by the young people in the three countries. And it provides some insight into the range of services that are needed by young people who are living on the street. It's important to consider for program planning purposes that the overwhelming majority of services were for contraceptives and for STI and HIV prevention. And it's interesting to note that there was a very small percentage of services related to gender-based violence and urology, but these are important. And the low proportions reflect the limited availability of these services on the service sites, and not necessarily lower demand. Something to keep in mind. Okay. So combining behavior change and prevention messaging with condom promotion was a big part of this initiative. So you can see this. All of these pictures are from the countries that we worked in. Condom distribution increased dramatically throughout the project, with over 700,000 condoms distributed. And the discussion with the population and the peer leaders at the initiation of the project revealed a huge demand for condoms. And in the context of all the challenges to using condoms among young people in general, the project was successful in combining the behavior change and prevention. All the peer leaders were all trained to talk about condoms in a way that was going to be meaningful to the other young people instead of just handing them out on the street. Okay, so in terms of support for the providers and self-care, which I mentioned already, working with young people can be really emotionally draining, and we created a survey tool to identify the gaps in core competencies for working with vulnerable young people. as well as identifying key areas for self-care. And there's a burnout scale that was created, and that's to help monitor provider needs, including, you know, emotional stress, the lack of reward, the lack of support, and the results serve as planning and management tools for long-term sustainability of the programs. And these tools are available, this is the link, on the IPPF WHR website, and there's some postcards in the back that have the website on it. There's a whole toolkit on how to work with young people living on the streets or young people living in states of vulnerability, and so that provider toolkit is also part of that. Okay, so here's some of our results in terms of behavior change. So we did a behavioral surveillance survey, which was adapted from something that had been used by Family Health International, and we found that in all countries there was an association between the intervention and behavior change. So in Peru, to highlight, if you look on the right column, significant health behavior changes occurred from the baseline to end line. Virtually all respondents at the end line demonstrated the highest possible scores across the key outcomes. So for example, over 90% of those surveyed in the end line had ever used condoms and were currently using contraception. That's one example. Based on this information, we can say that the intervention appears to be effective for the entire population across all outcome measures. Okay. In Guatemala, one highlight is that there was a significant effect on contraceptive use when education and services were combined. And that's something that we talk about all the time at IPPF, so it's kind of nice to see it come out in the numbers. There was a synergistic effect of combining education and services. Greater than either just clinical services or education alone, I should say. Oh, and that's what's reflected in this chart too. Great. So in Bolivia, we used a sampling plan designed to include youth with no exposure to the intervention, and the analysis examined the differences between the intervention group and the non-intervention group, and that's how we came up with this. They suggested that the treatment dosage is associated with higher odds of reporting condom use during a respondent's last sexual encounter, after adjusting for gender, age, city of residence, risk group, and knowledge about STIs and HIV. And so while education and services are always meant to complement one another, these data make a strong case for combining the approach. All right. So two other really interesting aspects of this project were that at the same time we were working to change policies that affect young people who are living on the streets or young people living in vulnerable conditions, and we did a cost study, which, and I'll talk about them one by one. So complementing the program strategy with policy work was a guiding principle, ultimately to hold governments accountable for addressing this unmet need for this population. And so in Bolivia, we achieved a municipal ordinance including the rights to services for young people and a resolution to support HIV prevention and condom promotion. In Guatemala, we combined efforts with local advocacy groups and contributed to a variety of legislative changes. In Peru, there was a public policy created for comprehensive free health coverage for vulnerable youth that was passed in a huge slum in Callao, if anyone knows Peru. And protection norms for violence against youth, norms to mitigate SRH access, and participation of young people in regional government plans were also achieved. And in terms of the cost study, this was a really interesting aspect because it goes back to the idea that programs for vulnerable youth are not sustainable and that they cost more than the benefit, and you know, and they're basically charity is what a lot of people say. But we implemented a cost study in all three countries, applying standard methodology, and the insights gained from the study have shown that basically this work is less costly as time goes on, that there's an initial investment, but that as the program expands, there's likely to be a significant drop in the average costs. The results provide a solid basis for estimating the cost of adapting the program to other countries in the region, which is certainly something we'd like to do. So the upfront investment in developing and testing the service delivery models will result in lower long-term costs, but only if there's a commitment to continuation and expansion. If anybody's interested in the specifics or we have any economics folks here, I have the information, but Essentially, the average cost per service across the three countries came out to between 7 and 8 euros. It's in euros because of the European Commission. So, and the lab donors, when they hear that, say, oh, that's really not that bad. All right, so in terms of replicability, you know, there's really not a lot of documentation on service or educational models that are effective in optimizing health and social outcomes for these populations. So this project represents an important contribution and an evidence base for promising approaches. There's a great potential for scale out and replication beyond the project sites, given the tools that we have now available. And we took a lot of those tools we've taken and we've really adapted and brought them down. The initial knowledge, attitudes, and practices survey that was used to get those results that I showed was pretty unwieldy, and I think that it's been very nicely edited down, and so the version that's on the website is a lot more usable and something that we certainly hope to use in some other countries. And just in general, this work demands institutional commitment and continued funding, as all work does. So, but currently we are continuing, I would say all three of these countries are continuing work with these populations to some respect. Okay. So just to provide some conclusions and recommendations, reaching the poorest and the most at-risk young people is possible, and it's of an essential strategic importance to meet the international commitments, such as the Millennium Development Goal objectives of poverty reduction, universal access to care, and eradication of HIV. This project has established some promising approaches for reaching very young adolescents, who continue to represent the most vulnerable and most underserved subgroup. Changing health behavior and effective prevention is possible with vulnerable young people, especially through livelihoods initiatives. I didn't talk about that too much, and I don't know too many of the details, but I know that the partnerships with the other organizations involved some job training and things like that, so that was a really important element. Building on the existing resilience, assets, and skills of these populations that have mastered survival in the face of these challenges will enhance efforts to change health behavior and effective prevention. And also, effective youth participation is key in order to advance these outcomes. Vulnerable youth were involved at various levels of the program implementation, from the planning stages, the needs assessment. They were involved as peer leaders, as I mentioned, and they were also involved in the evaluation. So, promoting girls' empowerment and addressing violence are vital. I said I wasn't going to talk about gender, but here's my one gender point. The project was successful in reaching vulnerable young women and girls, despite their relative absence in public spaces as compared to the boys. It's critical that protective factors are enhanced in order to really include the girls and promote gender equity within a program like this. Further strengthening the institutional response through transferring effective models of care to government entities is also really essential. And finally, the vulnerability of young people is generated by the environments that they live in. And in order to ultimately prevent poor health, social, and economic outcomes, all sectors have to collaborate to address the unhealthy and unsafe environments. This includes examining the risks that the physical environment creates, shaping the social environment and mobility. Future interventions can incorporate an even broader perspective on health and its determinants in order to leverage the advances that were made through this project. So that is essentially it. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, and I'll leave you with a picture of some of our young women. Great.
I think we do have maybe a couple of minutes if we want, if anyone has a question for Marissa. Pat?
You just said that girls' empowerment and addressing violence was essential, but I didn't even know how to address violence.
Yeah, that's a good question. As I said, I don't really have a lot of specific details of how the program was implemented because it came on at the end, but I can try to find out more information for you. I know that at IPPF in general, when we do sexuality education as well as clinical services, we integrate violence messages within the education program. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the clinical services, we do detection of gender-based violence, and I know that was included in this program as well. So there's detection and referral of services.
Thank you.